You're listening to the highlights from the Creative Processes interview with Jacqueline Gottlieb, Professor of Neuroscience and Principal Investigator at Columbia University's Zuckerman Mind Brain Behavior Institute. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
Nature. So we all experience the sense of awe. And I think that's a beautiful sense because, I mean, you're awed at the vastness of things, at things that go beyond your capabilities, also capabilities of understanding and capabilities of knowledge. So I look at it as kind of a form of extreme uncertainty that is not threatening. We can relax. It's pleasurable and inspiring. So maybe if we can remember the sense of awe that we have with certain things, we can help ourselves when we have uncertainties that are threatening. Maybe that's something that we can use to calm us down. About dealing with climate change. I mean, people do adjust. And I think we should enable, as far as policy comes about, I think a lot of policy has to be geared towards allowing people to adapt. Let's say you think that sea level will rise in a particular area. Well, you can build a bigger dam, right? Or you can build bigger walls. So we have to allow people, the more resources people have, the more efficient they will be in adapting to whatever comes their way. Well, I mean, climate change is, you know, people adapt, right? The climate changes. I think, again, I would caution against this extreme reaction. I hear people say, are things going to be, you know, there's this spectrum of catastrophic climate change. We're going to have, everything's going to flood and we're going to have a lot of hurricanes. And what is the probability of that happen? It's actually very small. How much do we know for certain that that happened? That also has a huge band of uncertainty. So it's a very uncertain, very unlikely catastrophic outcome. But because it's catastrophic, people tend to focus on it. Again, it draws our system one. I think we need to moderate our thinking also about climate change. I feel like some things are catastrophized, like some risks are blown out of proportion. And when we go to that regime, emotions take over and our system one takes over, a very fast emotional system, and we stop thinking. So again, I would push people towards the uncertainty. Do we really know? What do we know? Maybe the temperature has risen, but maybe by less than you think. And it's not only one thing. If the temperature rises, then other things can compensate for it. The effects are mitigated. So we need to moderate our thinking. We need to calm down, you know, slow down and think. Okay, the world is still standing. It hasn't fallen apart. Everything's fine. Take a breath and keep thinking. And the other thing is that human capacity for adaptation is always overlooked. Humans are incredibly adaptive in general. Animals are very adaptive, but I think humans may be the most adaptive to different conditions. And also remember that, for example, in the 1800s, whenever it was, there was a scare that raw materials will run out, copper will run out. Oh, absolutely. And at the current rate of consumption, you can absolutely show mathematically that here are the reserves of copper and this is how much we're using. And so it's easy to extrapolate and say we're going to run out in 50 years. And guess what? We haven't run out. And what is the fallacy there? The fallacy is thinking that we will be the same in 50 years that we are now. And in fact, we are not the same because that's what we're built to adapt. And guess what? People stopped using so much copper. They found other things, right? They were totally unforeseeable. Well, I came to neuroscience from a humanistic perspective. So I was very interested to find out, you know, who we are. What do we know? What do we think we know? Why we think we know certain things? How do we see things? How do we perceive? And then I discovered, I was amazed by the precise way that cognitive neuroscience can measure these very elusive mental functions like attention or memory. You know, it's something that happens in our head and it's very fleeting. And yet there are experimental methods to really pinpoint them. And slowly I zeroed in on eye movements as this incredible marker of internal cognition, right? So if you want to know what somebody is interested in or thinking about or what information they're processing, eye movements are by no means a perfect marker. It's a very noisy marker. But still, it's one of the closest one that we have as an index. So what do eye movements tell us about what we think, what we find interesting? And ultimately, that's the question behind curiosity, is what things do we find interesting in our environment? So in my line of work, the way I think about eye movements is that they really are trained in some largely subconscious process. And so I liken eye movements to how we learn to control our skeletal movements. So how do you learn? How do you stand up right now? How do you sit? How does your body maintain its posture? It's an enormously complicated process. There are tens of muscles being controlled in very precise balance, but you're entirely unaware of this. And I think that we see similar things when people do tasks, like if you prepare a tea or if when you drive, people have very, very consistent patterns of eye movements that are very exquisitely coordinated with what they do with their body. Very reproducible, very consistent. You can also see that they are learned. Imagine you are on an island, you're stranded on an island, and you somehow are totally paralyzed, and there's nothing, you can't do anything, but you can move your eyes, okay? If you are alone, you will die because you cannot, in order to communicate with the external environment, you need to exert force with the muscle. You need to grab a fruit with your hand or chew it. You need to exert force. And eye movements do not exert force on the world, right? They're not that kind of movement. But if you have another person with you on that island, you can communicate just using your eyes. So you can act on a social being, or even maybe if you have your pet dog, you can communicate with them using your eyes, right? So in a social context, eye movements can signal your intentions and, in a sense, act on other social beings. So they do have a communications role. Why curiosity has been neglected? Yes, that's a very interesting question. And I think that there are good reasons for it. So scientists like to be reductionists, right? And we take brain and behavior, they're hugely complicated questions. And so we simplify them in order to study them in the lab. And the way that our field has simplified, our field has pursued two major traditions. One is the cognitivist tradition. So people like William James and many others who really are fascinated by mental operations. So things like attention or memory or mental imagery, things of that sort, language. People study the capacities. What is it that we can do? What are the limits? How many items we can memorize for how long and so on and so forth. The other half of our field studies decision-making, studies motivated behavior. That is, what do we like? What do we want? How hard are we willing to work for something we want? And those fields have really split. So the decision-making half of our field was dominated by behaviorism. You might have heard of B.F. Skinner was the founding father of behaviorism. And their feeling was, well, you know, all this mental stuff is a bit elusive and I don't know how to measure it. And it feels like magic and hocus pocus. But here's what I can do. I can take a rat and put it in a simple cage and I can make the rat very hungry. And I can give it a lever that delivers food and a lever that delivers nothing. And I will tell you precisely how many times the rat will press the food lever as a function of time. And I can describe its behavior super precisely. And I can make equations and I can link this with economics. And that's all you need to know. It's just a stimulus response agent. And it's all about motivation and rewards and so forth. And that field has gotten really very far and has described a number of phenomena. But what happens is that these traditions have continued, each one on its own track, but they have totally become separate from each other. And we have a big social divide among researchers that pursue these questions. So you have on one hand, people who talk about cognitive processes like memory and attention, but they never ask about motivation. I think that we're now at a point where each field is developed enough that there really isn't anywhere else to go unless you combine the two, okay? And curiosity is precisely the intersection of those things. So curiosity has to do with the desire for information, okay? So what is that about? Well, I need to know how I process information, what information is, and I need to know whether I want it or not. So that's precisely curiosity. And the reason we need to study it now is because, well, the time has come to unify these. And it's a huge undertaking, I mean, because we're talking on each side of the cognitivist and behaviorist traditions, you have hundreds of scientists working on each side. They each have their own ideas. They each have been educated in their own tradition. And linking them, it's going to take several decades, I think, to have a good integration. It's just starting. There's truly has been an explosion of research. When I started thinking about this question, I could barely find anybody who was interested in it. It's just, we didn't even know how to begin to ask the question. How to begin? How do you even formulate that? And that is precisely the gap between those two fields, because we need to understand how you process information, how you understand the task, how you cognitively represent the situation. And then we need to understand what you are motivated to do about that situation, in this case, with your eyes. I think that the way that I tend to think about eye movements is in terms of a question and answer. So I think about the act of making an eye movement is a question that you pose to the world. And you answer that question for yourself by looking at someone. For example, when you look at a weather forecast, you have partial reliability of information. And then you combine how uncertain you were to begin with the new information, and you weigh them by their reliability. If you think the reliability of your source is low, then you're not going to listen to it that much. But if you think the reliability is high, you should listen to it more. And then you update your beliefs. And the problem is that knowing these probabilities is extremely difficult. What the probabilities are that we're talking about, what our questions are, it's extremely difficult. And the mathematical theory doesn't tell you that. So really, to understand the questions that an individual has at a moment in time, you really have to kind of understand the entire individual, what they know and what they care about. Like, it's really the entire individual. And I wanted to say, because you talked about social communication. So I think that eye movements in particular really have two functions. One is answering our questions, like I said, gathering visual information. But the other question is in social signaling. In a social context, eye movements can signal your intentions and, in a sense, act on other social beings. Those are very important questions. I think that our brain is equipped to deal with the onslaught, because for the simple fact that we have an onslaught of information the moment we open our eyes. I mean, we evolved to deal with an onslaught of information, and we are masters at focusing and ignoring vast amounts of information. Now, AI, this digital age, is a relatively new stream of information, yes, and it's man-made, so we make it more salient. So yes, it's harder to ignore it. And so people can learn to ignore it. And indeed, it's a learning process. And I think it will require also learning how to teach our children. I mean, we're raising generations of kids who will take the AI and digital world as a given. To them, it already is. No more different than, you know, a chair and a table were to us. And so they will learn to not be so distracted by chairs and tables. People adapt. You know, our brains are very hierarchically organized. At the highest level of the hierarchy are our wants and values. What do I need? You know, we all need to eat. We all need social contact. We all need safety. That's the highest level of the hierarchy. Then you have your values, right? You know, social values and moral values. And then you have your knowledge, your long-term knowledge. What do you know about the world? That determines how you interpret everything around you. So what do you know about the world? What more do you want to know? What are your competencies? What do you know how to do? And so those levels really control what information you're seeking in the moment by moment. Yeah, well, this is my favorite thing about science, is that you can be creative. And I absolutely think that science has to be just as creative as art. It's just that we have different ways of generating questions and answering questions. So if you ask somebody, what is curiosity? Probably the answer you'll get most frequently would be the desire to know. But I think that a much better answer is the desire to ask questions. And it's very different. So if you've just mapped out your living room, you got to say, okay, now I need something new. I need some uncertainty. I need to go outside, even though it might be scary. I need to expose myself to that uncertainty in order to learn. And then once you've gone out to your yard and you've learned that yard, you say, okay, well, now I know my backyard. If you don't talk about curiosities, I mentioned the cognitivists and behaviorists, all the neuroscientists, they think of information as being given to you, like bottom up. Again, signals come from the outside. But once you realize that this is impossible, that the outside world is way too infinite, so that's not how things happen. Instead, what happens is that your brain sort of builds yourself. You build through all your life experiences. That is your knowledge bank, and that is what generates your curiosities. You asked how growing up in Israel influenced where I am. I think the way it influenced where I am, I think it's interesting. It's being in between. So I'm a product of, my dad was Jewish and my mother was Christian, Orthodox, Romanian. So I was, in that sense, born confused. I mean, I never belonged to any group. I always felt like I'm in between two camps, like between two major traditions. And also, I was born in Romania, and I was educated in a European, Romanian way, more Christian than Jewish. And then we moved to Israel, and that was a big culture shock. And there I was exposed to more Judaism and the Israeli reality, which was very different. And I think that that's how it shaped me. I mean, I'm not a tribal person, for better or for worse. I don't associate with a particular group, right? One of the most fundamental values that I learned from my dad is tolerance and open-mindedness. And, you know, you have to take every person at face value. So this is what I think, maybe that's the most profound influence on me, is that I'm always open-minded and I always want to look at both sides. And this is why I think I sense this social divide coming to psychology and neuroscience. I noticed that for many of my colleagues, they were perfectly happy. You stay in your lane, you stay in your tribe. And as long as your tribe agrees with you and you agree with them, you're happy. And you never need to get outside of that. But I'm someone who needs to get outside the tribe. I mean, I map out the borders of my tribe and the way I was taught to think, but then I'm like, wait a second, there's a lot more out there. I need to go out. And I don't want to see competition. So my tendency is to bring things together. That's funny. I never quite thought about this in the context of my life. But I guess I think that's what shaped the way that I think. Well, I mean, I do think that one of the most important things that neuroscientists can put out there is people's reactions to uncertainty. And, you know, information is actually all about uncertainty. I mean, some people are more willing to embrace uncertainty, especially if they can learn from it. Some people actually would do anything to protect themselves from uncertainty. So this is part of the echo chamber phenomenon. I mean, maybe what this other person is saying has something, a grain of truth to it, but it's just so hard for me to think about it that I'd rather ignore it. I'd rather stay into my safe space. So anyways, people differ. There are emotion reactions. There are cognitive reactions. And I think that this is where our thinking and our emotions are very closely intertwined in how we deal with uncertainty. I guess I would exhort young people to keep an open mind. One thing that I try to teach my students is to think about, for example, when you read a paper or you hear somebody talk about their experiment, try to think about what is not there. Try to bring yourself, you're paying a lot of attention, all your resources are consumed by understanding what the person says. But see if you can take a mental step back and look at what they say from a slightly different perspective, right? Look at the contradictions. And don't be afraid of the contradictions, because those are the fertile ground for making progress, right? So look for the contradictions. Contradictions are good for scientists. If you find it, the more glaring it is, the more progress you can make by trying to resolve it.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.